First of all, thank you for coming to this series of wonderful programs on Yellowstone. I think how fortunate we are to live in or immediately adjacent to the Greater Yellowstone. It is such a privilege, and I would add such a responsibility for all of us. In the next few minutes, I'd just like to share with you a few notions, how I was introduced to the concept of Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem, what led me to write about it in 1984 and again in 1991, what I learned about the concept of a Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem and how that can be, I think, applied today. And then I want to say a little bit about some insights that I learn along the way. From there, I'll describe what I believe are important and not always recognized values of the resources within the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem. Want to say a little bit about how we can actually define boundaries. There are people in this room I can see out here who should be doing that, but you can get my opinion on that. And then I want to conclude with a very short story about exchanging correspondence and then going to California and meeting Horace Albright. He was the first civilian superintendent of Yellowstone National Park and the man that I would credit more than any other single individual with the creation of the Grand Teton National Park that we know today. It's a little known story, but he played a key role. I arrived in Mammoth in the Lamar Valley in 1981 when Mary Lee and I came, left a good job in Helena with benefits and retirement to go to work at the fledgling Yellowstone Institute. We had quarters at both Mammoth and Lamar, and that year we were fortunate to have a home right next door to John Townsley, superintendent of the park. And shortly after our arrival and meeting with Townsley, he took me aside one night and told me that he just returned from Washington, where a newly appointed Secretary of the Interior, Jim Watt, had told him, if you ever go outside this park again and talk about area or resources that is not within this park, that is not within your park, you will be immediately replaced. A few days earlier, Townsley had gone to Cody where they were having a public meeting on a Watt proposal to open tens of thousands of acres of the Washakie Wilderness to oil and gas exploration. And he went over there and he said, you know, just on behalf of bears, we've only got a couple of hundred at most right now. And we know for a fact that, I don't know, 12 or 16 are denning in the Washakie. So we want you to be careful about that. He told me the evening after he arrived back in Mammoth from Washington that we have got to start thinking in terms of a Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem. We can't think about this area as a bunch of parcels on a map. So he said someone should write a book about that. And 2 years later, after the conversation with Townsley, the first edition of the book, Greater Yellowstone, the National Park and Adjacent Wildlands, was published. Townsley didn't live to see the book or the creation of the Greater Yellowstone Coalition, never knowing that the seeds he planted on the steps of his back porch in that evening would bear such fruit. I don't know where John first heard the term Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem. I do know that in Frank Craighead's magnificent book in 1979, He used the term at least once, and in his book made several other references to the Yellowstone ecosystem, but the track of the grizzly didn't say much about the concept of a greater Yellowstone or the criteria for delineating its boundary. But in any event, the publication of the book represented a modest layman's approach to these and other questions, wherein I began by defining five themes that I thought needed to be explored. The first was Yellowstone National Park is an extraordinary ecological treasure, and it exists within an ecological context we call the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem. The entire Greater Yellowstone ecosystem is an international treasure. Most resource management decisions are made in a fragmented manner that have nothing to do with ecosystems. And the environmental integrity of the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem is being increasingly diminished. So anyway, let's talk about, just for 2 minutes, the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem and the resources it encompasses. It is extraordinary. Some are extremely rare, such as the collection of 10,000 thermal features, and especially the geysers. There are more geysers in Yellowstone National Park than in the rest of the world combined. Another major feature we don't think about very much is the remarkable petrified forest. And there are others, such as the certain hot water micro life that is extremely rare. It is the headwaters origin of three major rivers, the Yellowstone, the Snake, and the Green. The area holds an astounding array, unmatched almost in biodiversity. The largest population of elk in North America, the country's largest herd of free-ranging bison, two significant populations of grizzlies in the lower 48, an enormous diversity of 95 mammals, 316 bird species, 22 fishes, 24 reptiles and amphibians, more than 12,000 known insects, 500 reported species of fungi, and virtually all of it within this watershed. And this map that we've got up here, highest right, the Continental Divide, the first trickles of the Yellowstone Snake and the Snake River are born. And as you know, the Yellowstone finds its way to the Missouri, the Snake flows to the Columbia, and the Pacific, and the Green to the Colorado. But other major headwaters here include from northwest the Madison, the Gallatin, the Yellowstone, the Boulder, the Stillwater, and the Rosebud. Come around northeast to north central, you have the Lamar, the Clarks Fork, the Shoshone, the Graybull, and the Wind River. And southeast to the west central, the Green, the Salt, the Snake, the Gros Ventre, and the Henry's Fork. So when we talk about these outstanding resources within the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, that's a big one. Now add to all of that just one more fact. Across this 20 million acre expanse, it is overlain by dozens of political and administrative boundaries, including parts of three states, 14 counties, 24 cities and towns, 2 national parks, 3 national wildlife refuges, 5 national forests, and parts or all of 7 wilderness areas. Now, herein lies the problem. You've got one ecological feature in the ecosystem, and you have a lot of fingers in the pie trying to decide how to manage it. But remarkably, it does remain today essentially intact. The last thing I want to talk about is defining the boundaries. for ecosystems. Any definitions must start with a list of components and the time frame that considered. In the case of the Greater Yellowstone, a variety of different components, geology, soils, vegetation, wildlife, hydrology, elevation, and use patterns are distinctly different from surrounding areas and suggest roughly the same boundaries. By the way, if you think about geology, then you can think about soil. If you think about soil, you think about vegetation. You think about vegetation, you think about wildlife. You think about hydrology and elevation and use patterns. It draws a pretty clear boundary for what we can call the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem. In the 1984 book, I summarized a definition of the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem as an area containing all the elements required to perpetuate all the indigenous species of the area. And a superb 1990 draft profile of the GYC, they likewise summarized the definition as where natural processes and disturbances of large magnitude are allowed to operate with minimum human manipulation. And in 2012, the U.S. Forest Service came up with a very, very specific criteria for defining ecosystems. And it's an administrative regulation, and it's probably the most useful thing that's come along in the last 50 years in that matter. Finally, in recent years, the term coordinated management has been used by some federal agencies to describe management that they believe is crucial to the future of the GYE. But coordinated management and ecosystem management are not the same thing. The ecosystem is viewed and treated as one dynamic element. And management, in coordinated management, they seek not to protect and preserve all of the species and all of the processes. They are looking at primarily economic things, grazing, logging, you name it. In ecosystem management, you're seeking to maintain linkages between species. You are seeking to maintain processes, and this is why the all-important aspect of ecosystem management is something that we really need to lay our hands on. Finally, as kind of a sidelight here, I had this correspondence with Horace Albright in 1984, and later met with him in California. And as just two snippets out of the correspondence said, I would like to take a little more of your time and tell you that I knew both William Henry Jackson and Thomas Moran intimately until their deaths. Mr. Jackson died at the age of 99, and I delivered the eulogy at his funeral. Now, think about this. I knew a man who knew a man. We're only two generations away from the first real occupants of this area. And I guess the question I raise is, what sort of changes have we seen across the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem in 2.5 lifetimes? And looking forward, what sort of changes can we anticipate, and what can we do about that? So that's my pitch, and I turn it over to Todd.
I want to talk tonight about, some of you have heard parts of this before, but I want to talk about where we are with Greater Yellowstone. This is Rick Reese's book. This is a copy of what it looked like. It came out in 1984. It is the seminal book that really laid out this notion of a greater Yellowstone ecosystem. 1984, I was in my early 20s, ended up getting a copy of this. One of the really strange things today is that I think in the 80s and 90s there was actually a better public understanding of Greater Yellowstone than there is today in terms of the sense of spirit and what we were trying to do. I think all of you in this room looking around, we've all seen the evolution of the ecosystem concept. We have better science today, and yet I don't think that there is this full appreciation. So I want to show a couple of images. But before I get there, we throw around this word Serengeti. We make a reference to the Serengeti as if Greater Yellowstone has to live up to the Serengeti. It's just rubbish. This is our Serengeti, but it's a point that deserves its own reference point because in many ways it does things that the Serengeti doesn't do. We are the richest country on earth, and by dint of miracle, we have things that rival this, truly. So this was a map from Rick Reese's book. We knew in those days, in the early 1980s, that elk move. We knew that they move from high country to low country, but we really didn't know how they move. We didn't know the places that they move through. This is another map, Greater Yellowstone Elk and Mule Deer Range. All of this stuff was identified rather presciently by Rick Reese in his book. And we've come a long way, just as we've come a long way since we knew grizzly bears roam the landscapes and we put radio collars on grizzly bears thanks to the Craigheads who had a presence around here. We've moved a long, long way. This, to me, is the radical organizing principle. So we move from this and that to this. As a journalist, I've traveled around the world. I've written for National Geographic and others. This is the thing. This is the radical step forward. Because when Rick Reese was writing his book, we thought of Greater Yellowstone within static terms. We thought of it mountain ranges and rivers that flow one way. But this is something that carries, this is the backbone of the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, and this is why it's worthy of a comparison to the Serengeti. So I want to tell a little story here. It's pretty cool. So if you haven't heard of Mule Deer 255, she is a doe. She started down here and she was radio collared in 2016. She was netted and fitted with the collar, and she rambled up here. They followed her all the way up to Island Park, Idaho, near our southwestern border. And they thought it was this freakish thing. They didn't know what was going on. And so she navigates the western side of the Wind River. She navigates a predator gauntlet here, a road gauntlet, a people gauntlet. Many of you know that I've written a book about Grizzly Bear 399 and that Grizzly Bear 399 lives along the roadway in Jackson Hole. Well, Matt Kaufman, who heads the Wyoming Migration Initiative, said, went up to that very spot where 399 was crossing the road, and it turns out that Mule Deer 255 crossed in the same place. And she goes up along the northern side of Jackson Lake, crosses over the Tetons, and comes up to Island Park almost into our state. 250 miles. The longest known one-way trek of a mule deer ever. And then her collar goes dead. The collar signal. Nobody knows what happens. Is it this freakish thing? And then this past winter, she is captured again, and a new collar is put on. And so this summer, she followed the same way and got up Island Park. She's going to be headed back through the same gauntlet. This time, the autumn gauntlet includes hunters. So you think about these migrations. These have been going on for 11,000, 12,000 years. they were going on, they're matrilineal, they're taught, mammals are taught through behavior how to navigate, unlike birds and unlike fish and unlike sea turtles where there's a genetic component in them. This is taught from mothers to their offspring over generations. So when this first mule deer migration likely began, it was 7,000 years before the Egyptians built their pyramids. This is like a native language written across our landscape. And it exists in our ecosystem and nowhere else. And so here we have this component, this unmatched component of every major species that was here when Columbus arrived. It's here. This doesn't happen. These critters move across the landscape. It doesn't happen anywhere else. And yet we treat Greater Yellowstone. I don't mean to be a scold, because I've been guilty of doing it, but we treat it as if there's another Greater Yellowstone over the next mountain range, and there isn't. This is different from Canada and Alaska because of the high concentration of people in the American West. There's a lot going. 90% of the American West is urban. Did you know that? And yet we still think of it. We still have legislatures that have a rural mindset, and yet most of the people are clustered in cities. One more thing. Why is it that we have all the animals here? Exactly. Unpopulated by a lot of people. So this is really cool, too. This is grizzly bears. This is where they were in 1980, 136 or fewer, mostly in Yellowstone. Over time, we've seen how they've expanded their range. And this week, we had a decision from Judge Christensen, who has said recovery isn't having a grizzly population that exists as an island, but to connect it as a metapopulation to the population in the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem in Glacier Park. That's why wolf delisting was held up in the upper Midwest, because it was just island populations. And for those of you who were here and were fortunate enough to hear my across-the-street neighbor, David Quammen, David Quammen told you that species go extinct at faster rates on islands. And so we've got a lot of threats going on in Greater Yellowstone. This is a picture that Tom Mengelson took in Jackson Hole, 399, teaching her cubs how to kill elk calves. And right up here is Jackson Lake Lodge. What's not in this scene are 200 people out having cocktails and drinks, watching this predator-prey relationship worthy of the Serengeti playing out. 399 is not a human-habituated bear. She is a human-tolerant bear. And so here we are in our fair city, Bozeman, Montana, which we all love. My presentation tonight is really meant to be a love letter to this ecosystem, and we're the capital city of Greater Yellowstone. We're the largest city in Greater Yellowstone, if you count the county. 104,000 people as of right now. So according to the local newspaper, Gallatin County is expected to hit 145,000 people by 2060. So from there to there. How many of you think that is a rapid increase in numbers? So that was calculated at a 0.8% annual increase. The actual increase, we're at about 4%. Bozeman proper has been at in some years 5% growth. The county you have about 4%. And so what does this mean? So what it means is that projection that was published on the front page of the paper is that we're going to get to 145,000 in 2060, when in fact, if you use the rule of 72, where you divide a growth rate into 72, you get the number of years that it takes to double a population or an investment or anything else. So in 2035, we're actually going to hit 208,000 people. And that's a little more than the size of Salt Lake City proper today. Not the metro area, Salt Lake City proper. So Gallatin County, Bozeman are growing from about 104,000. If we double again at a 4% growth rate, if we stay steady at 4%, we're going to hit 416,000 people in 36 years or 2053. So a year ago, Mountain Journal, the group that I founded, we wanted to have a better conversation about this. We wanted to have an adult conversation instead of wishful thinking or living in denial. We published this image. And there was a hue and cry, and people said, there'll never be the IDS building up in front of the Bridgers. It wasn't literal. It was to make a point. And over the last year, most of the people who are in denial, and if you drive around the Gallatin Valley and you come upon new subdivisions, you know. And most of us are from somewhere else. Most of us have seen high growth areas. And yet, this is a little map, that hand-drawn map that I put together. We have this quaint sense of place here. We think it's never going to change, even as it changes before our eyes. And yet, this is the reality. So by the middle of the century, at current growth trends, not including some external factors, Bozeman becomes Minneapolis size. You look at Big Sky, if it spills out the west side of the Madisons, and if the Jack Creek Road is open and Ennis becomes a bedroom community to Big Sky, it isn't hard to imagine within a human generation and a half that this becomes Jackson Hole-sized. But you fit in a Bozeman between Gardner and Livingston, Cody swells, you've got Billings that ends up trending. Billings is consolidating people. The urban areas are consolidating. That 90% is clustering in pre-existing cities. When this map first appeared, someone called me up in Jackson and said, I can't believe that you'd have a population equal to Salt Lake City proper. So I said, let's get a cup of coffee. And on the back of a napkin, we added the population, current population of Idaho Falls, Rexburg, Jackson, Teton Valley, and Star Valley. And as many of you know, because of housing prices in Jackson, people are being pushed to the other side of the Tetons. It's a problem that's even more acute than Bozeman, people being displaced to Belgrade, Manhattan, or who knows where else. So we sat down, and guess what? The current population between there and there is currently Salt Lake City proper size. The question is, where is the next Salt Lake City size going to fill in here? And one of the interesting things in terms of connectivity, to get back to the grizzly bear conversation of establishing a metapopulation for true recovery, because metapopulations, large populations instead of isolated ones, are more resilient to change, to disease, to other factors, with climate change and population pressure being a big one. So this is a corridor here that goes up and connects into Idaho and up into the Bitterroot. And if there is going to be connectivity, it's likely going to happen in the Bitterroot with bears from Glacier coming south and our bears going north. And there's about 100 miles or so distance between subadult male bears meeting. It's going to be decades if they ever meet. So one of the questions that was raised by conservationists is, if we have a sport hunt of grizzly bears, will that end up stopping or slowing the progression of that intermixing that's going on? This is a different place. Within 17 years, we're going to have a Boulder, Colorado-sized population here. We're going to have 100,000 new homes in Greater Yellowstone in terms of the human footprint. This isn't speculation. This is at current growth rates. So again, we have this stuff going on. What's interesting, as you probably heard if you listen to Ray Rasker and Headwaters Economics, the key factors for driving growth are proximity to an airport. And after that, it helps if you have a federal presence and if you have a university. It used to be back in the 90s whether you had Federal Express and internet access. My kids can't They don't they can't imagine me typing my stories out and sending them off to a magazine and then waiting for the editor to do it. Everything is instantaneous. But it was slower in those days. So again, so we think about this. I want you to think about this, if we're headed in that direction, and this. So here we have the Paradise Valley herd. We've got another herd going up here across the Flying D Ranch, Ted Turner's ranch. We also used to have a herd of elk that used to winter, as many of us know, right off the Gallatin south of town. Guess what? They're not there anymore. Where did they go? Did they all die? No. A lot of them ended up over in the Madison Valley. So their change is already occurring on the landscape around us. And their change is caused by us. Rick had a great description of the number of species, but there's only one species that's affecting all those others. So the question is, this to me is the cohesive thread in Greater Yellowstone. All of those animals that you saw earlier that are here, this drives biomass. So those elk, tens of thousands of elk that are moving across, they support the predator populations, the scavenger populations. They ensure healthy grasslands and healthy soils, sequester more carbon than anything else. This is the life support system. It's been likened to the pulmonary or the cardiac system. And like the pulmonary or cardiac system, if your arteries get blocked, you have a major event. So, what are the other external factors? So, we know the growth rate, that we live in a pretty great place here. We love it. So, what happens when temperatures now that shut down the Phoenix airport at 116 degrees, what happens when summer temperatures are an average of 10 degrees hotter? What happens when Lake Powell goes permanently dry because there's no snowpack? What happens when cities like Houston are underwater? A good friend of mine here tonight is Brian Yablonsky. He's the former chairman of the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission, and he works for PERC. I interviewed him for a story on black bear hunting in Florida, and he's moved up here and he's taken the helm. We had a great chat about climate refugees. Tell me if it's not real that people are packing their bags in coastal Florida and moving because of saltwater incursion and higher tides, right? It isn't a future fantasy. It's happening right now. Where do they come? So just today in The Guardian, we're moving to higher ground. America's era of climate mass migration is here. That's the story today. So if we're at 4% growth rate, what does this mean? Are we prepared for this? This is Aurora, Colorado, a western suburb of Denver, largely unplanned for the inundation, not known for its wildness. This is Mesa, Arizona. This is growth based on the premise that growth is good. Some have compared the growth is good at any cost to a Ponzi scheme in which you get behind on that and so you beget more growth to pay for the growth that you can't pay for now. So it becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy. Boulder, Colorado. Portland, Oregon. Often we hear our city leaders, who are friends of mine, liken us to Boulder or Portland. The problem is that when you liken yourself to a place, you end up becoming that place. And what do Boulder and Portland not have? They would fantasize about having this. They might have smart growth. They might be. But you know what? It doesn't matter if you care about this. So I want to talk a little bit tonight about being a journalist and kind of watching this. So what do we do? The question is, it's easy to just gripe about stuff, but there are things we can do, and one of the things is we can plan. We have no plan in the Gallatin Valley right now. There is no cohesive strategy to think about this between our city government and our county government. The county government doesn't buy into this. They don't think it's important, and yet this stuff feeds a $1 billion annual tourism economy. All we have to do is keep it going in Yellowstone and Grand Teton, worth $1 billion a year, increasing annually. So we don't have a plan. I don't understand why we're not talking about this stuff. So how do we maintain this if we don't have a plan? I would argue we need to elevate our game of ecological literacy. And it starts with all of you guys in this room. And unless you think that this matters and help become evangelists out there, it isn't going to matter. We happen to live in this place. We get to live in the American Serengeti. I try to do this as a journalist. But we all need to do this. In fact, I'm looking around tonight. We should all have our kids or our grandkids here tonight. Or we should be talking to them. And ecological literacy, just as civics has been a casualty in schools, we should be talking about ecology in this place that's unprecedented. We need to talk to each other. 20 counties in Greater Yellowstone. There was a conference last week, a great conference in Big Sky hosted by the Greater Yellowstone Coordinating Committee, and guess what? There were 4 county commissioners there. 20 counties in Greater Yellowstone and 4 county commissioners. There's never been a summit between city leaders and municipalities on Greater Yellowstone. Counties used to get together, by the way, back in the 80s and the 90s and talk about this stuff. But if we don't have a plan and we're not talking about this stuff, there's no way we're ever going to save this place. Ecologists on staff. I was involved in historic preservation for a while, and there was a push to have a historic preservation officer. That's a great idea. Why don't we have ecologists on staff? If there isn't an ecologist who's given license to scrutinize development, how do we know what we're losing? Seems like a pretty simple investment. There are no ecologists on staff. So if you don't have that kind of scientific expertise, basically the issue doesn't exist. The real costs of growth. We love our schools. I voted for every school referendum out there, and I know many of you have. And now we've got a jail bond that's coming up, and it's likely to go down in defeat because people feel like they're overtaxed. And we've got growth in a Ponzi scheme, and we're going to grow to pay for the growth that we have now. And if the argument is that we can't afford an ecologist, then growth isn't paying for itself. So what do we do about taxes? I'm not suggesting we raise taxes on ourselves. We need to tax visitors. So why is it? Remember I mentioned 90% urban? We still have a Senate that is dominated by rural legislators who have a grudge against Bozeman and Gallatin Valley because it's heartbreaking that they're losing people. It's heartbreaking that their kids want to come here and they don't go home. But we're being punished and we're not allowed to tax visitors. It happens everywhere else in the world. And where could some of our tax dollars go? They could go to incentivize landowners. Brian Yablonsky with PERC has taken on this elk migration issue. You said last summer at a conference, it's about public lands and private lands working together. It's not at odds. All of these migrations Summertime, they're all on public lands, and on wintertime, they're often on private lands. Or they're moving between ranges across private lands. So unless we incentivize private property owners, it's going to be game over for these. It only takes one subdivision in some of these places to clog an elk migration corridor. And so again, I'll lean back on the county and the city. It does no good to have infill in Bozeman if it's open-ended into the county. It's farcical to say that we are appreciably protecting this if we're only focusing on infill, because the pace at which we're growing is exponentially faster into the county. So if we don't have the counties engaging, we're going to end up with a lot of infill, and we're going to end up with a lot of sprawl. So it's very important that you ask questions. So when a journalist is up here, it's important that you bombard the journalist and not believe anything that he says. Check it out. The slogan at the City News Bureau of Chicago was, if your mother says she loves you, check it out and provide at least 3 verifiable resources. So when I say something on this, challenge me and demand answers. But demand answers from our electeds. Force them to answer these questions, or we're going to lose this. This is an American treasure. It belongs to everybody. 9 vote. You know, it's interesting, in the last election, I'm not going to presume where anybody voted or what their values are in this room, but I interviewed Ralph Nader in 2001, after the Gore-Bush election. And elections matter. And Nader felt no sense of contrition for what happened, but the country went on a different direction than it might have been. So we're sleepwalking through a lot of these things. We just assume that if we follow the same patterns and we listen to people who say growth is inevitable, we will become Aurora, Colorado, or we'll become Mesa, or we'll become Boulder, and we won't have the critters out there. We'll be a great place to recreate, but we won't have critters. Why aren't there critters in Boulder, Colorado? And media scrutiny. Media has got to apply more scrutiny. To me, the worst part of the decline of the mainstream media is that we have a lot of veteran reporters who just aren't being rehired. We've got a lot of kids coming in, but they don't have the experience to be able to analyze things. They're not able to think about growth. Here's the fact with growth. We can't emulate Portland and Boulder and save what we have. We have to become the place that other regions emulate. We have to become whatever the Serengeti is. We have to become that thing that the rest of the world points to. Limits. So what would each of us be willing to live with? Less of. So mountain bikers accuse me of beating up on them when they try to undermine the Wilderness Act. And they say, I want mine, I want mine, I want mine. It's a lot. Most of us in this room have embraced conservation just for its existence value. We may never get to that place. Our support for conservation isn't conditional. But what are we willing to live without? After all, Yellowstone was this construct of saying we're not going to let manifest destiny sweep across Yellowstone. And so Greater Yellowstone itself is an expression of that. So this is what we think about in Yellowstone. This is the idol that we all love. Really, it is an honor. We think about Yellowstone as this hellhole to visit in the summertime when we don't, you know, we'll take our visitors there reluctantly. This is what we live for. This is what the reality is. By the way, we've got Norm Bishop here. I once got him in trouble when he took on Alan Simpson going out and evangelizing for wolves, and I think we should give him a round of applause. Wolves would not be in Greater Yellowstone were it not for, in part, for the heroic efforts of Norm Bishop. So thank you. And I'm going to embarrass you one moment here. So he read from Aldo Leopold, and he read, we were with Dave Meach, the world's foremost wolf biologist. We were at Roosevelt. This was a few years before wolves were brought back. And Norm read the journals about the last wolves that were extirpated from Yellowstone, and he wept. And I think for all the folk there, there wasn't a dry eye that night. So he's an example of a civil servant who has heart. So, Dan Wenk retired over the weekend. He had his retirement party. Remember the rule of 72? You divide whatever the percentage rate is and you figure out the rate of doubling. Yellowstone's visitation is growing at 3% a year. In 18 years, Yellowstone today has 4.2 million visits. So what would Yellowstone look like at 6 million visitors or 8 million visitors? So anybody who suggests limits is going to come under political heat. And so what's another thing everyone in this room can do is you've got to say that you embrace limits. And you got to stand up for the park superintendent. Limits as in quality versus quantity. So it's interesting. The Yellowstone Club accepts limits on number of people. It's been a great business proposition. Their golf courses are, ironically, I don't mean to beat on the Yellowstone Club, but they accept limits, use their golf courses as wildlife migration routes, except that Big Sky itself is a black hole for grizzly bears, and the Madison Range has been biologically decapitated and will be further so when the Jack Creek Road comes in. So we're going to have a north and south Madison Range there. But think about limits. We accept limits for most things. None of us who ever had kids in school say that having 200 kids in a classroom is better than having 35, or going to an opera with 50,000 people in the stadium. So why can't we do that with Yellowstone? Again, 4.2 million visits, what's it like at 6? Early 1990s, I was back interviewing Malcolm Wallop, the late U.S. Senator from Wyoming. And Malcolm said, you know, why can't we do things like Disneyland does or Disney World? You know, we're all like, are you kidding? But one thing that Disney World does is it moves lots of people through. And so maybe we need to be thinking about radical ideas to separate people from cars. So we have an $800 million maintenance backlog in Yellowstone now. And so by the time you fix one stretch of roads, has anybody been in the park recently? I was in traffic for almost 2 hours a few days ago driving from Norris Junction to Mammoth. It was a nightmare. And so we built these roads over old stagecoach routes, but you know what? If we had gotten the monorail that Wallop had, things would be a lot different. And so maybe that's part of the infrastructure we need. Maybe some of the money that we generate from tourists should go toward a monorail. We could move people through, get people out of their cars. We could stage them in gateway communities. All in the name of protecting this. And the thing is, none of us, including our elected officials, can claim that we don't know any better. We can't claim that we're sleepwalking. This is going to be a conscious decision of, because this stuff exists right now and they're still filling in mule deer and pronghorn migrations. We have the longest pronghorn migration known in the world. We have the longest mule deer migration. We have the elk migrations, second only to the porcupine caribou herd in the Arctic. and it's all right here. Some of us would lift a finger in a nanosecond to stop a highway from going across the Serengeti. But we think of this place different. It just amazes me that we do. So one thing about political correctness. You know what? It's absolutely true that the conservation movement has been dominated by white males. And it's absolutely true that we need to radically change that and have inclusion. And I deal with a lot of young people who make that point. Here's an interesting thing about Blondie the grizzly bear. It's her nickname. She doesn't care what one's skin color is or what their background is. All she cares about is whether they protect habitat for her. And so what we're really about at Mountain Journal is trying to give voice to critters and trying to give voice to landscape that those animals need. We're interested in solving the human problems of inequality and inequity, but these guys really need a voice. So game changer. We can change the game. We did it this, a great technology disruption to bullets with bear spray. So the media, too, needs to be ecologically literate. The papers around us that we read, the websites that pass as citizen journalism and there's no accountability, if the media isn't ecologically literate, dispensing the information, it's bad news. So I like to think we aren't so much anti-science as we are pro-myth. I'm sorry, Jeannie, your answer was correct, but Kevin shouted his incorrect answer over yours, so he gets the points. Facts do matter. So we founded Mountain Journal a year ago. We're now the most widely read online social media entity in the Northern Rockies. And we have one of our columnists over there. Would you stand, please, Timothy? Timothy Tate. Lori Riker, are you here? Timothy handles the psychological dimensions of change, and it's been incredibly well read. And Lori is writing about the interface of architecture and how we plan and how we can do a better job of reducing our human footprint. She has a great piece out. Timothy has a great new piece out, too, about how do we save the Valley of Flowers. So we're trying to have mixed voices in. If any of you have great ideas, contact us. MountainJournal.org. We are a nonprofit media enterprise, much like NPR, PBS. So the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem, I mean, it isn't just this construct. This is the most exciting thing in terms of a wildland complex, and we get to call it home. And so I hope that no matter what you do, because I bombarded you with this map, I hope it gets laser imprinted on your brains, because it's really important. So thanks for coming out tonight, and if you have any questions, Rick and I will be happy to answer them. Thanks for coming out.